York Times Company petitioner versus L.B. Sullivan. Mr. Wessler?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This case is here.
On January 6, 1964, Chief Justice of the United States Earl Warren gaveled in a case that made history in this country. A Montgomery, Alabama police commissioner named L.B. Sullivan had successfully sued the New York Times for libel in the courts of his state. The Times was appealing. Constitutional law scholar Herbert Wessler represented the paper.
This case is here on writ of certiorari granted a year ago to the Supreme Court of Alabama. The writ calls for review a judgment of the Supreme Court of Alabama, which in our submission poses hazards for the freedom of the press not confronted since the early days of the Republic.
Civil rights activists in Alabama had placed a full-page ad in the New York Times containing several minor inaccuracies. It didn't name Commissioner Sullivan, but he said it defamed him anyway. Sullivan's lawyer, M. Roland Nachman Jr., tried to convince the Supreme Court that if the press didn't pay a price for mistakes that harmed public officials, the press would harm the Republic.
As I understand their contention, if a newspaper charges, say, a mayor or a police commissioner with taking a bribe, that there is absolute immunity against a libel suit in that regard, and we think that's something brand new in our jurisprudence. We think that it would have a devastating effect on this nation.
But the court ruled unanimously for the New York Times and held that in order for a public official to sue for libel, that official must prove that the offending statement was made with actual malice. And ever since, New York Times v. Sullivan has been a foundational principle protecting freedom of the press. But now that just may be changing. Candidate Trump kickstarted today's debate in 2016 at a rally in Fort Worth, Texas.
I'm going to open up our libel laws so when they write purposely negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money. We're going to open up those libel laws.
Trump couldn't keep that campaign promise, but now two members of the Supreme Court, Justices Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch, have called for those powerful Sullivan protections to be revisited. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This hour, calls to change the laws around freedom of the press. Joining me from Salt Lake City is Rennell Anderson-Jones. She's a professor of law at the University of Utah and a fellow at the Yale Law School Information Society Project. She clerked for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and she's a former journalist. Rennell, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Kimberly. Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Wilmington, North Carolina, is David Logan. He's a professor of law at Roger Williams University and former dean of the university's law school. In 2020, he published an article in a law journal titled Rescuing Our Democracy by Revisiting New York Times v. Sullivan, which Justice Gorsuch referenced in his recent dissent. And we have a link to that article in our on our website, onpointradio.org. David, welcome to you, too.
Thank you.
So, Rennell, I want to start with you. We have that historical reference now of when New York Times versus Sullivan came down. Sort of give us a clearer understanding of what the landscape was like before the Sullivan decision and how it changed it.
Sure. Pre-Sullivan framework really didn't have a constitutional consideration for how defamation law would be handled. It was left to the states to think about how to structure their defamation landscape, and most of them structured it based on the basic elements of the English common law. So a plaintiff, a person who thought that they had been defamed, would only have to show that they were identified and that something defamatory about them was published. They didn't have to show falsity, and they didn't have to show any fault. They didn't have to show that the newspaper or the entity that they were claiming libeled them had done so knowing that it was false or recklessly disregarding the truth or even that it had behaved negligently. And that framework meant that in situations like Sullivan that you just described, it was quite easy to prevail in those situations.
And this was an ad that was placed in the paper. I think it's important to note this was an ad that was placed by civil rights activists that had a few minor inaccuracies about exactly what police were doing to protesters there, correct?
That's right. The important gist of the ad was, of course, true. It was highlighting something that was critically important, that this group of activists were pointing out violence and illegal tactics that were being used to quell peaceful civil rights struggles. But the ad had a series of small factual errors. It said, for example, the police had ringed the campus when they instead just lined up in front of it, or that the protesters were singing "My Country, 'Tis of Thee" when really was the national anthem, or that Martin Luther King Jr. had been arrested 7 times when really was maybe 4. They were factual errors, but they were untrue.
And David, the standard that came out of the Sullivan ruling of actual malice, can you sort of briefly explain to us what that is and how it changed the landscape of libel law?
Sure. First of all, as Ronell said, for hundreds and hundreds of years in England and later in the United States, this was a strict liability offense, which meant that if you made the statement and it was of and concerning the plaintiff, then basically your case is done. It's up to the defendant then to defend themselves through various possible defenses, including that it was true. That's often difficult to do, and so placing the burden of proof is a significant issue. And secondly, the type of proof that the plaintiff now had to adduce, starting in times and for over really a decade following it, became increasingly difficult to satisfy, to the point that basically a plaintiff, in order to win a libel suit now, at least a public plaintiff, public official or public figure, has to prove that actually the defendant consciously lied before publishing. That is a very high, we call subjective standard. And as a consequence, and perhaps intentionally, but in any event, as a consequence, very, very few plaintiffs who are considered public officials or later public figures really have a serious chance of ultimately prevailing in a defamation action. And the data supports that out. As Justice Gorsuch noted, we have very, very few jury trials anymore on these issues. And the outcomes of these cases are almost always heavily on the side of the defendant, even if the material that was published was in fact false and defamatory.
So, David, you're saying that essentially when you have this balance between press freedoms and the public's right to know and the ability of people who believe they have been defamed to seek some sort of redress, be made whole, or punish the people who they say defame them, that the balance of that has shifted and now it leans more farther to protect the press.
I'd go further. I said it shifted dramatically. And as I wrote an article back in 2000, looking at the data, it says a plaintiff in a libel action is about as likely to win as being struck by lightning.
So so we fast forward and we will get to how Justice Gorsuch cited your article. But in the past 5 years, there's been a shift. We heard from then candidate and now former President Trump saying he wanted to open up the libel laws. We heard for the past couple years Clarence Thomas in dissent saying that he believes that the Sullivan standard needs to be revisited. And then a couple of weeks ago, Justice Gorsuch wrote in a dissent that denied cert to another defamation claim that he thinks it also needs to be revisited. He wrote, what started in 1964 with a decision to tolerate the occasional falsehood to ensure a robust reporting by a comparative handful of print and broadcast outlets has evolved into an ironclad subsidy for the publication of falsehoods by means and on a scale previously unimaginable. Ronell, how do you see the landscape shifting, and what are your thoughts about the concerns that Justice Gorsuch highlights here?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that Justice Gorsuch's point is incredibly well taken, that the media and political landscape in which we live is vastly different than it was at the time of Sullivan. That's always true. Constitutional law, and particularly First Amendment law, always have to move and keep up with and apply old standards to a new media ecosystem. It's the name of the game here. Gorsuch's approach here is actually quite different than the approach that was taken by Justice Thomas in his opposition to Sullivan. Justice Thomas was, for a while there, sort of all alone with what some thought was sort of an idiosyncratic view of the First Amendment, taking a purely originalist position that the court should only protect things that the founders would have protected in 1790 without consideration of modern realities. Gorsuch's approach is actually, in some respects, the flip side of that. His position is that because of changing realities, that Sullivan should be reconsidered because it no longer makes sense in our new political and media landscape, which I think is a signal that the threat to Sullivan isn't limited to that sort of idiosyncratic outlier originalist position that Justice Thomas holds, but may in fact be broader. I would be very nervous about a dynamic that threw Sullivan out with the bathwater because of changing facts on the ground, because it has been so foundational to our conversations on matters of public concern in this country.
And David, just in the few seconds before we go to break, do you think this has the potential to be a game changer?
I certainly hope that it opens up the conversation about, as Ronell said, one of the foundational decisions. But looking at it through the eyes of an evolving constitution and an evolving media and political landscape.
All right. We're going to talk about new calls to revisit the 1964 Supreme Court case, New York Times v. Sullivan, the legal principle protecting freedom of the press. When we come back, we'll look more closely at why some people think that ruling doesn't work in an internet age. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This hour, we're talking about new calls to revisit a key principle of U.S. libel law that holds public figures to a higher standard. My guests are David Logan, professor of law at Roger Williams University and former dean of the university's law school, and Ronell Anderson Jones, a professor of law at the University of Utah. We're going to dig deeper in a moment into this new debate over whether Sullivan has outlived its purpose, whether it needs to be revisited, and what it would mean for the country. But first, we reached out to a First Amendment lawyer who has relied on Sullivan to defend his own clients.
I'm Steven Zansberg. I'm a First Amendment media lawyer in Denver, Colorado, and I represent the Denver Post and newspapers, and I've represented the New York Times and CNN and multiple news outlets, litigated dozens of defamation cases, including those brought by celebrities from Aretha Franklin to Andrew Keegan, I believe is his stage name, numerous government officials.
Zansberg recalled one of those defamation cases where a sports columnist got his facts very wrong.
One case I worked on that demonstrates the utility of the actual malice standard was a case a number of years ago brought by the owner of the New Jersey Devils NHL franchise, a fellow named John McMullen. And he had purchased the Colorado NHL franchise and moved it out to New Jersey. So a sports columnist for the Denver Post by the name of Woody Page. He wrote a sports column lambasting Mr. McMullen for having stolen the Colorado team like a thief in the night. But what Mr. McMullen was quite angry about and sued over was a line that said he left behind significant unpaid debts. What happened was Mr. Page had confused Mr. McMullen in his article with another sports franchise owner who had left behind significant unpaid debts, and it was an honest mistake. And so the case got thrown out on that grounds.
The Sullivan ruling means Zansberg wins a lot more cases than he loses. So we asked him what he thought about Justices Gorsuch and Thomas's calls to revisit the 1964 ruling.
You know, I could be wrong, but I don't lie awake at night worrying about whether New York Times versus Sullivan is going to be overturned. I do think it would be a terrible substantive result for us as a nation if it were to be overturned. But I presently don't think it's an imminent concern.
That was Steven Zansberg, a First Amendment media lawyer based in Denver. And Ronell and David are still with us. David, I want to turn to you first because you have been critical of Sullivan. And we talked about the article that you wrote that was cited by Gorsuch and his criticism of that. What is your reaction to the fact that in most cases, it's almost a foregone conclusion that the press will be on the winning side of defamation cases?
Well, first of all, I don't think we should be killing the message because of the messenger. I'm a lifelong, what they call in the South, a yellow dog Democrat, and the fact that Donald Trump has a particular view that I might agree with, to me, doesn't automatically mean the view is without basis, even if in that case it was not terribly well articulated. But I think that what Justice Gorsuch is concerned with, and this was really the focus of my article, was the dramatic change in our public square from the 1960s to the current day, and really the reality that we now have what some people call an infodemic, vastly broader, dangerous, quick spread of false information, primarily because of the internet and social media. And that just wasn't even in the wildest dreams of the nine justices back in 1964 when they decided the case. The second point is I think it's important not to call this conversation overturning New York Times v. Sullivan. I think that's dramatically oversimplifying the position that I take and Justice Gorsuch takes as well, which is there are a number of cases in the decade after New York Times where the Supreme Court and a number of lower courts dramatically expanded the sweep of New York Times well beyond the easy case in actual New York Times v. Sullivan, which was an unnamed local city commissioner suing about relatively trivial matters reported by a national media organization where no one in Alabama read, that were like a total of 300 papers circulated that day in Alabama, and gets the equivalent of a $4 million judgment. I don't think there's anybody that says that was a verdict that should have withstood constitutional scrutiny. But what's happened, particularly in the decade after, is we have a whole ecosystem of broad definitions of terms. For example, a cop or a teacher has to carry this high constitutional burden in order to get to a jury in a defamation action. Bill Cosby's victim had her case dismissed because she had the temerity to get into a public exchange with Bill Cosby about his misconduct. Alex Jones turned people into a public figure by accusing the parents of Sandy Hook victims of being somehow conspiring to create the story that there were shootings there when there really weren't. Those are cases that I am sure if you ask the nine justices today, should the Constitution broadly protect those kinds of outcomes? I'm pretty confident, at least for six of the nine justices, the answer would be no, it's gone too far. And I think what Justice Gorsuch is saying, it's time not to reconsider New York Times, the core holding, but the many emanations from New York Times, which I call the New York Times ecosystem, that has tilted the stage so dramatically in favor of liars and defamers and so far away from the interest in A, protecting reputations, and B, the having at least some concern for veracity of commentary that comes into our public square, because you can't have an operating democracy if lies go unchallenged.
And Ronell, to that point about the Sullivan ecosystem, to borrow David's phrase, I want to read another quote from Gorsuch's dissent. He says, "Now private citizens can become, quote, public figures on social media overnight. Individuals can be deemed, quote, famous because of their notoriety in certain channels of our now highly segmented media, even as they remain unknown to most." So what do you say to this idea that social media and the changing, even the changing legacy media, have made the idea of what a public figure is, whether for general purpose or a limited purpose, as the subsequent cases after Sullivan laid out, how broad, how much more broadly it has expanded those protections?
Yeah, I think it's a fair point that more people are potentially public figures, that notions of virality and fame are more slippery in the current media environment than they once were, and that this might, in Gorsuch's view, create unfairness in ways that weren't envisioned at the time that Sullivan was decided. And I think it's also a fair point that Gorsuch makes that it's harder now to determine, right, everyone now might be a publisher and a disseminator, right? The go-betweens and a gatekeeper, a fact-checker, distributors of news are changing and being replaced by these other forms of mass dissemination of defamation in ways that some folks think weren't imagined by Sullivan in the cases that were decided on the heels of Sullivan more than half a century ago. We should point that Justice Gorsuch, I think, is taking a sort of intellectual curiosity approach to this. He was asking in this case to reconsider the Sullivan body of precedent. Justice Thomas, who is the other vote here, has indicated that he would like to overturn Sullivan, right? So that's on deck for him and is in play. And I think that it's, of course, the case that Sullivan isn't just about protecting a free press, although it certainly is that. It's also central to the operation of American discourse more broadly, protecting the citizens' right to have robust conversations about elected officials and other powerful people without fear of crushing damages. And it would be a massive alteration to American-style free speech to lose it. And opening the door to this, I think, raises important questions for us.
And David, I have a question. Given, even if we take Justice Gorsuch's concern about the changing media landscape and social media, and certainly about the rapid spread of misinformation, is changing or revisiting the Sullivan standard the best way to address that? For example, when you're talking about social media and misinformation, often the purveyors of that misinformation are anonymous, or it's helped by foreign actors who will be well outside of the reach of a civil lawsuit. Is this the wrong way to go about addressing this?
Again, I think that's a little bit of a straw man here, with all due respect. We've got hundreds and hundreds of cases. In fact, one handed down by the Rhode Island Supreme Court last week, in which a couple of cops were accused of unethical behavior. It turned out to be false. They sued, and their case was dismissed, and the dismissal was upheld by the Rhode Island Supreme Court because cops are considered public figures or public officials in that case. I think our democracy wouldn't be hurt very much by asking or insisting that before the paper of record publish that allegation, they actually do a thorough investigation, not make one phone call and then publish. The one phone call that verified a complicated story was enough for the trial court and eventually the Supreme Court of Rhode Island to say, sorry, no way to do this. And what was interesting was in the last page of the court's opinion, they recognized, one of these two very important consequences of the New York Times line of cases. One is reputations can be destroyed with no recourse. And I'm willing to put reputations in the balance against robust debate and have robust debate almost always win. But I'm not willing to put democracy and reputations in the balance and say that vigorous reporting always should win, because that is not the way in which democracies function. We have to have a common understanding of what the facts are before we can exercise the franchise and be engaged in government and be informed voters and all those important parts of that. And as you extend New York Times from the narrow context of a true public official who wasn't named, who suffered actually no harm, probably was actually elevated in his community by the New York Times coverage, to then say every cop, every rape victim, every person whose kid is killed in a mass shooting has to prove actual malice to recover damages, that's just not a good balance. It's not fair, and I don't think it serves democracy well.
So I want to continue talking about how these issues resonate today, but just to get a fuller understanding, I want to go back to the Sullivan case itself when it was argued at the U.S. Supreme Court. And here was the Times lawyer, Herbert Wechsler, setting up the main questions of that case.
The questions presented are, in general, first, how far the civil law of libel may be used by state officials to punish the publication of statements critical of their official conduct or of the conduct of the agencies of which they are in charge. And second, how far a state may force a newspaper, which publishes 1,000 miles away, to defend libel actions instituted in its forum.
So, Ronell, this case, we were talking about this case, but this lawsuit was one of several against the New York Times at that time for its coverage of the civil rights movement. In this case, before it was reversed, the plaintiff in the case won a $500,000 verdict. But the New York Times was facing millions of dollars, which would be much more in today's money, in potential liability for what it has printed. So how does that translate in today? Isn't there still a danger that someone can create a campaign against a particular news publication, essentially trying to put it out of business? Recently, Gawker was the subject of several lawsuits in that vein, the online publication, and it did have to fold eventually. Are you concerned about that kind of action taking place again?
I am. I think there's a very real risk of that. And I actually think in recent years, we've seen increased conversation and increased efforts by public officials and other powerful public figures to try to wield this tool to shut down their critics. And this is what leads me to think that there are some real risks that adjustments to this doctrine could compound, actually, rather than alleviate the really serious problems of speedy, widespread social media disinformation that Justice Gorsuch is identifying. Defamation law on the one hand and the widespread problem of disinformation on the other hand are not really actually neatly matched. And as you said, anonymous online posters of information are often just outside the reach of libel law. They're not the entities that are regularly sued for defamation because they're hard to find and hard to sue and not often worth suing. No one individual who spread that disinformation had enough of an impact or enough assets to be worth going after in a long, tedious, time-intensive tort suit. But the press, in contrast, they have deeper pockets and they're therefore, you know, a target on their backs for the kind of situation that Sullivan addresses. And they also have libel insurance policies, which individual random disseminators of disinformation online, of course, do not. So in other words, these hard to find individuals with few assets and random scattershot roles in spreading falsehood that are the examples that a lot of folks are drawing upon to describe how much the media landscape has changed just aren't as likely to be defendants of libel actions in any event. the Sullivan standard and defamation law more broadly are maybe not the sensible, efficient wheelhouse for dealing with this. And it seems deeply unlikely that the best tool that we're going to use to solve our colossal online disinformation problem is expensive, time-consuming defamation litigation against the masses of social media participants who spread it. And what this means is that the worry here might be that reconsidering Sullivan creates a vulnerability for those entities that are attempting to maintain some reputation for transpartisan neutral news gathering and fact checking with no real payoff in tackling the wider societal problem that's driving that reconsideration.
David, we'll come back to this on the other side of the break, but just in a few seconds before we go there, what's a starting point if we are just reconsidering Sullivan? What's a starting point? Where do you think what could be changed first?
The sweeping definition of who is a public official and who is a public figure, that means that tens of thousands, maybe millions of plaintiffs have an insurmountable barrier to, a practically insurmountable barrier to winning a defamation action.
Okay.
That's where I'd start.
Okay, so we'll come back to that on the other side, and we'll talk more about what this country's media and political landscape would look like without New York Times v. Sullivan. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. Tomorrow, we're rethinking the work week. A recent study based out of Iceland found that working a 36-hour week without deduction in pay improved employees' happiness without compromising their productivity. Do you think a 36-hour or 4-day work week would be possible for your job? What would the extra time allow you to do? Do you work for a company that offers a 4-day work week already? How has that compared to your experience working 5 days a week? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about new calls from two Supreme Court justices to revisit New York Times v. Sullivan, an almost 60-year-old ruling protecting press freedom, and we're asking what it might mean for those two justices to convince others on the court to join them. My guests are David Logan, professor of law at Roger Williams University, and Ronell Anderson-Jones, a professor of law at the University of Utah. Now, David, you had just started about how you think we can relook at Sullivan, and I want to give you an opportunity to continue.
Thank you. I think what's in store is a conversation about pruning, not eliminating New York Times v. Sullivan. I think it's very important not to take the alarmist position that the core principle of New York Times v. Sullivan, that high public officials who are defamed, allegedly defamed, have a very high barrier before they can recover damages. I don't think there's anybody out there, and even Justice Thomas, I think you have to be careful. He's talking about public figure cases, not public official cases. So I think it's important to recognize this is it's important, but relatively narrow subset of the New York Times ecosystem. And I think it's important just to note that when people say, if we tamper with New York Times and any of its emanations, any part of the ecosystem, we're going to see the end of democracy and the end of robust coverage of politics and life in this country, that we're an outlier, that there may be some other country out there that gives the same degree and scope of protections to false speech that hurts people's reputations that we do. but it's certainly not England's. And we got our law from England, and they don't have a New York Times principle. They have a much narrower set of principles protecting speech, and their democracy seems to be working pretty well. Their media seems plenty robust. So I think we have to be careful about the effort to say that any change in the New York Times ecosystem is a catastrophe for democracy and free speech. I think the evidence in other countries shows that's not necessarily the case. And I think that I happen to trust the Supreme Court, even though I don't agree with many things that Clarence Thomas writes, to look at this on a case-by-case basis and maybe do some judicious pruning and not allow for a full-bore attack on the core principle, which I think is extremely important and I'm confident will withstand any kind of serious attempt to overturn that core principle.
So, Ranelle, I want to ask you about this, about what David is talking about, not a full bore overthrowing of this principle, but is there room in there to tweak it, to change some of these standards in light of the way that the media landscape has changed over the last six decades?
Yeah, I think this is a really fair question. My reading of Justice Thomas's writing on this differs. I think he stated in a series of dissents from denial for certiorari that he would overturn Sullivan in its entirety and undo the constitutionalization of libel law, even for public officials. But I agree on the wider point of the ongoing need for us in every area of First Amendment law to think about how to map the current media terrain onto the legal landscape that the court has provided us. And this may well include thinking really carefully about how it is that someone becomes a public figure, how one has made the choice to thrust themselves into the limelight, how they what it takes to voluntarily expose yourself to increased risk of injury from defamatory falsehood and to engage the public attention in an attempt to influence the outcome of those robust debates. What it is that makes you a public figure, a person who's sort of akin to a public official in the sense that you enjoy significantly greater access to the channels of effective communication. The core principle here, I think, is really critically important that we hold on to, that people who have a realistic opportunity to counteract false information ought to do so rather than using the blunt instrument of crushing money damages with which to do so. We differ from other countries in the world on this, to be sure. This is because we have a First Amendment and they do not. We differ from other countries on lots of fronts because our Constitution elevates principles of freedom of speech and press in ways that other places don't. I think readdressing the sensitive dynamic between these sets of values that we really do hold dear, the right to protect one's reputation and the right to free speech and press, is going to be on deck, inevitably. Putting Sullivan at the centerpiece of it makes me nervous.
And David, I want to talk a little bit more about the point that we're making about who is a public figure and how far that goes. Is there not already room for judges? And just to be clear for folks listening, there for someone to be a public figure, they can be a limited public figure, which means just for a specific circumstance or a specific period of time, or they can be deemed a general public figure, like Cher. I mean, Cher is famous, so she is a public figure. Isn't there room for judges to make that determination based on the facts of a case, whether they should be considered a public figure for the purpose of that particular defamation suit? Isn't there room for the courts already to do that without changing the standards?
I think the short answer to that is no, that the lower federal courts and all state courts on constitutional law matters, which is what we're talking about here, have to follow the Supreme Court decisions. And it'd be very unlikely for a judge to say, you know, the public figure definition that's been around for 45, 50 years is wrong and ought to be changed to protect the reputation of this particular plaintiff in this case. That's just not how lower court judges respond to the Supreme Court. That said, and I think this is really where Ranelle and I actually have a common view here, is that it is significant that Justice Gorsuch, who is not as much of a sort of consistent outlier in idiosyncratic justice as Thomas, writes this very lengthy and sort of a law review article about the problem, makes no effort to say I have a specific goal, a specific question I want to address or a specific change, but we ought to have this conversation. And I think, and we can turn to this in a minute, but I think that that kind of open-armed, open-eyed, let's take a look at a fundamental line of cases that may have gone too far and reached unintended consequences is appropriate for the Supreme Court that's construing a living constitution. That's not a position that a lower federal court or state court judge is at all likely to adopt, although Justice Gorsuch's opinion may make that conversation bubble up in a way it might not have even a month ago.
Well, speaking of Justice Gorsuch, during his 2017 confirmation hearing to become a justice of the Supreme Court, Senator Amy Klobuchar pressed him for his views on New York Times versus Sullivan, and here was his response.
New York Times versus Sullivan was a landmark decision, and it changed pretty dramatically the law of defamation and libel in this country. The Supreme Court said the First Amendment has special meaning and protection when we're talking about the media in covering public officials' public actions, and indicated that a higher standard of proof was required in any defamation or libel claim. Proof of actual malice is required to state a claim. That's been the law of the land for, gosh, 50, 60 years.
So, Ronell, he said then, 4 years ago, that New York Times versus Sullivan is the law of the land. And now, not only is he questioning whether that should be the law of the land, he quoted his colleague, now Justice Elena Kagan, a law review article she wrote years ago in making the case that this should be revisited. One, what do you think of that fact? And also, what are the odds that the Supreme Court actually will take a close look at the standard?
I've been invited to lots of panels and symposia and discussions about Sullivan in the years since Justice Thomas first approached this. And when asked that question, and in characterizing Thomas as an outlier here, I actually pretty repeatedly have pointed to that Gorsuch exchange with Senator Klobuchar to say, you know, we can read some tea leaves here. And it looks like lots of folks on the court, the most recent folks to join the court, think of Sullivan as settled law, approve of it, don't have any appetite for reconsidering it or its contours. It was offered up without caveat from Justice Gorsuch. And so the fact that someone who seemed squarely in that corner has now suggested to us that he's open to reconsideration and that he actively thinks that at least some contours of Sullivan and its progeny ought to be reconsidered, I think may be a signal. Justice Kagan wrote the article that you referenced close to 30 years ago in a book review. And so I think it's hard to use it as a data point for where she might be on this point. And of course, all of the other justices had the opportunity in both instances in which Justice Thomas has suggested taking a case and in this instance in which Justice Gorsuch has suggested taking the case to reconsider some aspects of Sullivan. They had the opportunity to join in and didn't do so. And this includes Kagan. Whether they've done so, whether they've made that choice because they think that Sullivan was rightly decided and all of the cases after Sullivan were rightly decided, whether they thought these cases were poor vehicles for thinking about this, or whether there's still confusion that folks at the court feel like they need to work through before they tackle this, I think we can't know for certain. There is a precedential value that is at stake here. The Supreme Court, as a matter of its own institutional integrity and goodwill with the people, does not want to be seen as an institution that revisits foundational precedent and reconsiders foundational precedent with frequency. And so some piece of what might be going on here is what Gorsuch himself reflected in those comments. This has been the law for 50, 60 years. At least the foundational components of it may be viewed as settled by a number of the justices.
And Ronell, what does the fact, though, that the media, the recent polling suggests that the public really doesn't trust the media, certainly not in the way that it did several decades ago. Does that change the way we look at this at all?
I think that there is good reason to believe that, I mean, we should note, let's just start with the proposition that Sullivan was unanimously decided. 100% of the justices on the Supreme Court voted for the Sullivan standard. Research that my co-author Sonia West and I have completed, empirical data suggests pretty strongly that the U.S. Supreme Court has generally overall soured on the press and press freedom. There's been a stark deterioration in both the quantity and the quality of the court's depictions of the press across a variety of measures. And there hasn't been a single positive reference to the trustworthiness of the press in more than a decade. So I think we can't be sure that if this court were to revisit the foundational doctrines, it would do so in ways that are favorable to the press function.
David, obviously, defamation law is just one part of the conversation about how we can protect against misinformation, what levers there are to warn against that or to punish it when it happens. What else do you think needs to be considered in this conversation? I know some folks have called for the Communication Decency Act Section 230 to be revisited. I repeatedly hear from folks wanting to a return of something like the Fairness Doctrine. What other elements here should we be discussing?
Well, I think you've identified two of the key ones. One is, of course, the idea that in 1996, Congress had to give protection to this nascent technology known as the Internet. And in this Communications Decency Act, Section 230, that you referenced, basically said that the platforms bear no responsibility for what's published on the platform. So Facebook, in general, has no liability, even though it leaves a post up on a Facebook page that reaches millions of people and that's defamatory and false and provably so. So Section 230 is without a doubt a big part of this conversation, maybe the largest part of the conversation. The Fairness Doctrine, which was also a federal rule for a long time and they got struck down by the Supreme Court about 40 years ago, could be one way to get at this. It's not fairness and truth are not the same thing, but it certainly would be something that could prompt more careful reflection before publishing. But I think it's important to return to the question of if the court created part of this problem, the court ought to clean up some of this problem. And the problem is the imbalance between plaintiffs who have false statements, demonstrably false statements published about them that can be harming to their reputation, and a defendant who does something short of a knowing lie, knowing they can be protected, 100% protected basically from civil liability. That just is the wrong balance of incentives. When we leave the classic case of Sullivan involving a public official who is hammered falsely in his public job to all these tens of thousands of other cases involving cops and firefighters and teachers and rape victims who are treated for all intents and purposes as the same way. They become collateral damage to an important constitutional principle. And so the Supreme Court made part of this mess, or not all of it. Certainly the statutory stuff comes from Congress. But I think Justice Gorsuch want to see the court take seriously the question of fixing it.
All right. David Logan is a professor of law at Roger Williams University. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Ronell Anderson-Jones is a professor of law at the University of Utah. Ronell, great to have you.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is On Point.